Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with two authors who will be appearing at Improv NOLA, a festival of ideas. Jules Pfeiffer is known for his cartoons, novels, plays and screenplays, illustrated children's books, as well as his most recent graphic novel, The Ghost Strip. And Michael Pollan, who has written so widely and beautifully about food and nature, talks about his most recent bestseller, How to Change Your Mind. It's an honor and a pleasure to welcome the amazing Jules Pfeiffer to The Reading Life. Jules has had one of the most remarkable and wide-ranging careers in American arts and letters. He published more than four decades of cartoons in the Village Voice, is the author of novels, screenplays, plays, and the author-illustrator of children's books, including Bark George and the beloved Phantom Tollbooth, written by his friend Norton Juster. He was also the first editorial cartoonist for the New York Times. Most recently, he's created stunning graphic novels. In 2018, he published The Ghost Strip, the concluding volume in a noir trilogy, Kill My Mother. His honors are many and well-deserved. New Orleanians will have a chance to meet him at the Improv Conference in November. Jules Pfeiffer, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. After that introduction, I have to go and lie down for a
while. Now, you said you have some very fond memories of New Orleans, so you're coming down to make some more, right?
Yes, and we're staying in the same hotel we stayed in years ago with my now wife. Then we were not married, and we're very excited.
Well, good. We are, too. Now, I was struck reading your memoir, Backing Into Forward, by how often the very word improvisation appears. You know, you could say that whole book is about how you've improvised your career step by step.
I'm still doing it.
Do you think things are catching up to you now? I mean,
no. I discovered that I may get into a funk because things aren't working right. And then I will realize when I sit down that I'm not happy about what I'm doing right now in terms of the book I'm doing. And there's something wrong with it. And I didn't know there was something wrong with it. And my inner thing, whatever that is telling me what my head wasn't telling me. And that's the way I function. You know, that I take orders from some undefinable inner urging that says good, bad, indifferent, no good, do it over again, and I just do what I'm told.
Well, the other thing that struck me is that you were in New York and Chicago when improv as a form was really taking off. You were very familiar with the folks at Second City in Chicago, that great center of improvisation. And you kind of kept yourself surrounded by master improvisers like Nichols and May, and you became one yourself, didn't you?
Oh, yes. I identified the first time I became aware of Nichols and May, and I talk about that, I think, in my Backing Into Forward, was that I was working in an animated cartoon outfit in New Rochelle, New York, called Terry Toons. And I come home one night and turn on Omnibus, which was the CBS program that was Alastair Cook. It was a middlebrow show for literate people. And Alastair Cook introduced Mike Nichols and Elaine May as I was eating defrosted tuna casserole or something. And I was stopped dead because they were doing what I was doing, except they were doing it live on stage, and it seemed to me they were better. But it was exactly the kind of approach that I was using to my work. And my first thought after it is, I got to find out who these people are. I got to meet them. I got to hang out with them. I got to be their friend. And in the case of Mike, that's exactly what happened. In years and years and years of friendship and often collaboration when we could do that.
Now, most recently, you've become a master of the graphic novel. So tell us about the Kill My Mother trilogy.
Well, again, this is due to the limitations. As I age, I found that I couldn't do theater anymore because of my hearing. There are other limitations on there. So I I started fooling around with some form of writing. I didn't know where it was going to go, and at first I thought it would just be a hack, moneymaker. I loved noir. I always loved noir from the time I was a kid. And as I fooled around with it, I got more and more serious. The only part of it I didn't like was that it was too much writing. So I thought, well, what if I make it into a graphic novel? And then it took off, and suddenly I had a whole new career I hadn't planned on. And it went back to the roots of the cartoonists who were my heroes when I was a boy. Milton Caniff, who created Terry and the Pirates, and who kind of defined what an adventure strip had to be and the direction it had to be, and with wit, dialogue, layouts, and all of that. And in particular, Will Eisner, who was my boyhood hero as well, and like me, came from the Bronx and was a prime influence on my work when I was young, and in terms of the graphic novel, on the three graphic novels I did. If without Eisner, I wouldn't have been able to do them. I kept going back and stealing from him.
Well, I love the characters. I love the way they look and the way they talk. It's such a tribute to those films, even those gray, kind of shadowy backgrounds.
And I had to learn how to do all of that. You know, I'd never drawn in that style, and I never approached that. What I did, well, I went out and bought a 60-plus inch TV. Started recording Turner Classic Movies from the period, or Turner Classic Movies that were made about that period. And I started sketching from the screen. You know, I pushed the pause button, started sketching from the screen, atmosphere and background and things like that I never could have accomplished without the help of the pause button and Turner Classic Movies.
That's amazing. That's just amazing. Now, two of the things that are requisite for good cartooning art, it seems to me, are, first of all, a distinctive line of your own, a style that people know and become familiar with and learn to expect, and recognizable voices. And you've had those things early on, the look of your art and the sound of a Pfeiffer character's voice. When we meet one of your characters, it's like we automatically are set to become listeners, or part of a conversation, or eavesdroppers. So how did that come to you?
That's a question I can't answer.
It's a gift.
I think it evolved out of beginning with being a boy in the Depression 30. I was an addict of old-time radio, and radio drama, and radio comedy, and radio, listening to radio, sitting down before this large console radio as if it were Buddha, some great God. And out of it were coming out these truths that began to define how I thought about writing, which I wasn't doing any yet, how I thought about humor, which I wasn't doing any of yet. I was absorbing an education while I was being entertained, and I thought it was just entertainment, but in fact, I learned about comic timing from radio. I learned about how to write suspense and build up a plot with pauses and silences and where to put it in the action, all from radio. And radio was a wonderful way in to what I was later going to do, because so much of it left something unsaid. And not saying it all and leaving it to the reader, or the listener in this case, was paramount in what I was doing. But all of this, at the time, I thought I was just having fun. And in fact, it was, you know, I learned a lot more from the entertainment form than I ever learned from 12 years of education in public school and high school, from which I learned almost nothing.
And also, if you're listening to the radio, you're not being bombarded with visual images. You're having to create your own inside your head.
Yes, the visual images are there, exactly as you say. And in your head, they are so exciting. Also, they're intimate. They're mm-hmm. personal. They connect in a way that television, as much as I love a lot of TV, doesn't connect in that personal way. There is something going on between you and the radio voices and your inner being that churns up and creates all sorts of things that may not be intended to. But for me, the style of improvisation that I was later to embark on, all of that came out of listening to radio and knowing what I was going for, even though I didn't know why I was going for it.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jules Pfeiffer, author most recently of The Ghost Strip. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
I'm curious to ask you, at the end of the version of Backing Into Forward that I read, you ended that with a note that was written in April 2009, and you were on such a high. You were having such a great moment, and you said you had rediscovered illusion, and you felt the glass was half full, and once you have illusion back, you knew it could carry you far, and you stared at your glass in wonder. So how do you feel now, 10 years later?
Well, I feel, following all of that, some of the things that I didn't stick into the memoir, Backing Into Forward, was at the very time I was talking upbeat, my then marriage was failing.
Oh.
I kind of turned my back on the fact it was failing because I had no intention of moving on. And then at 80, I did move on. And now I'm 90 and I'm having the best life I've ever had.
So, you're an inspiration.
For your listeners, I say life begins at 80. You don't know what you're doing until you're past 80.
All right. I'll hold that thought. I love that you end on a note in Backing Into Forward with Fred Astaire and saying that the best thing about being a cartoonist is that you can draw yourself as anybody you want.
Well, Fred Astaire was a major figure and remains so in my life because when I was a kid growing up during the Great Depression, it was the Astaire and Rogers film that lifted you out of the depth that you might be living in at the time with a sense of permanence. You didn't know when this period would end, and it lasted until World War II, going on from 1929, so it lasted a long time. But if you went to a Astaire Rogers movie, or you went to some other musicals, you went to 42nd Street, they changed the world for you, and they lifted you out, and they gave you a sense of possibilities and hope that very little in life was there to give you. I never had any religious beliefs, so I didn't think my faith was going to get me out of anything. So I shifted my faith to entertainment poems, to the movies, to Fred, to Ginger, to leaping above it all and rising above the problems, and somehow or other it was going to be okay, and it turned out that it was.
It was just a different kind of grace, you know?
Yes.
We've been talking with the brilliant artist and writer Jules Feiffer, who will be appearing at Improv NOLA, a festival of ideas, Saturday, November 9th at 7 at the Freeman Auditorium at Tulane University. Tickets are available at improvconferencenola.com. Jules Feiffer, thank you so much. It's been an honor.
Oh, well, thank you. I had a good time. And I hope I have a chance to meet you.
No mistake, brother, you surely got crazy feet. If you go off your nut, then you know you've got nothing else but crazy feet. Let's go boom and you take me.
I am so happy to welcome best-selling, award-winning author Michael Pollan to The Reading Life. Michael is the author of most recently, How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence, as well as 5 New York Times bestsellers, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, Food Rules, An Eater's Manual, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of 4 Meals, and The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World, as well as The Place of My Own and Second Nature. He's speaking to us today from Harvard University, where he's the Louis K. Chan Arts Lecturer and Professor of the Practice of Nonfiction. Michael, so happy to meet you.
Well, likewise, Susan.
Now, do you ever just look over at that bookshelf of yours and think, wow, I have really had some fun? You know?
Or I'm really old.
No, maybe that. I've done a lot. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, it's been an interesting path. When you hear the titles of the book, it seems incredibly various. But in fact, I've been following a similar path for a very long time, which is my obsession with the human engagement with the natural world and the ways in which we change nature and nature changes us and the various uses to which we put plants. That has been my big question. We use plants for so many different things. Food, obviously, is one, and I've written several books on food and agriculture. Beauty is another. But also, we use plants to change consciousness, and that's kind of the weirdest use to which we put them. And that really started engaging me when I was writing Botany of Desire, which looks at 4 plants and the human desires that they gratify and essentially use to get ahead in nature. And one of them is this desire to change consciousness. I looked at cannabis there, and I've always been fascinated by that. Why should it be adaptive for us to get high or have a psychedelic trip? it seems like it would be maladaptive that would get you into trouble, which, of course, for many people it often does.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out to be a universal desire. Every culture that's been looked at has some plant or fungus that they use to change their experience of consciousness.
Well, I was looking back over your work and I was trying to think what it was that I love about it so much. And it seems to me that the reason you draw readers in is because you're simply present, both in the moment you're writing about and then for the reader as well. I mean, you can make us feel the joy of cooking with Samin Nosrat in your kitchen, for example, or the trepidation you feel before you swallow mushroom tea at first. I don't know that anyone else, for example, has written so much about chopping onions. One of my favorite things you've ever written is about digging up potatoes and the happy feeling, the happy fit of a potato in your hand.
It's a treasure hunt, right?
Yeah.
Here they are. It's not just picking apples off a tree. You're digging, and most of what you see underground is of no value to us. And then suddenly these lumps appear, and they have this wonderful weight in the hand and texture, and they're so delicious, too. Yeah, I love harvesting potatoes. I am very present in my work. That goes back to, I started really as a personal essayist in Second Nature, writing about what was happening to me in my garden. And I've found since early in my work that if I could find a place to put myself in the story, to immerse myself in it, that would give me a narrative. And that narrative would often have a lot of humor to it, since I was a fish out of water. So when I wrote about the cattle industry for Omnivore's Dilemma, I bought a cow.
Oh, no.
I followed it through the process.
Yeah.
When I wanted to write about architecture in a place of my own, I built a little house, something I'd never done before, I was ill-equipped for. And you learn things from being inside that, you know, a process that you can never learn any other way. Even people who know it much better than you don't see it as clearly or freshly as you do because you're doing it for the first time. I really learned this, I realize now, way back when I was 13 or 14, and my parents gave me a copy of a book that I absolutely loved called Paper Lion by George Plimpton.
Ah, yes.
And in addition to the founder and editor of the Paris Review, he was a great sports writer, often for Sports Illustrated. And he thought that sports writing had driven itself into a cul-de-sac of conventions. And, you know, it was all the kind of cynical cigar-chomping guy in the press box who'd been around and seen it all. And he wanted to kind of enliven sports writing. And so he persuaded the Detroit Lions for this book he wanted to write on football to let him go through summer training camp and then actually start as quarterback in an exhibition game, allowing him to see football from the middle, from you know, deep inside, at great risk to his body, I might add.
Right.
It yielded this quality of wonder that only someone doing something for the first time can ever access.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful book, and it's very funny because he's, you know, he doesn't really know what he's doing. But you learn something about football you could learn no other way. And in retrospect, I realize that's been my model, although I don't endanger myself quite to the extent he was willing to.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Michael Pollan, author of How to Change Your Mind. This book has inspired some of your most philosophical writing and beautiful stories of these drugs as used for cures for existential distress, for people facing death and facing serious illness. And I think particularly of that moving story of Patrick Metis, who was part of the NYU study in 2011. Would you talk a little bit about him?
Yeah, Patrick Metis was a journalist. He was my age. He worked for MSNBC near the end of his life, and he had bile duct cancer. He was given, you know, only a few months to live and was suffering from terrible anxiety and depression. And he heard about a trial at NYU giving psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, to cancer patients to see if it could help with their, what the doctors called their existential distress. It's interesting, his wife was against it because she thought it signaled that he was giving up rather than fighting the cancer. And many oncologists were against it, too, that they saw it, too, as a defeat of some kind. But he had a powerful experience, what his doctors called a mystical experience. You experience this transcendence of space and time and the sense of ego dissolution and that you're merging with some entity larger than yourself. And he felt like he had had a glimpse of the future. He climbed this precipice, and this is in his imagination during the trip,
mm-hmm.
and looked out over this vast, what he called, plane of consciousness, and love was the theme of this whole environment. He, at that moment, felt he could go into it very peacefully, but he didn't want to. He really wanted more time with his wife. There was more he had to do. So he turned away and kind of re-entered life after that with a new equanimity about his death. The last 17 months of his life, he described to his therapist as the happiest of his life. Quite remarkable. And his wife felt the same way. And he died with remarkable peace. In fact, the people in the hospital, the staff of the hospital at Mount Sinai in New York, would gravitate to his room because he was just putting out this vibe of tranquility. It was an amazing story, and I talked to quite a few of the cancer patients, and many of them had had similar experiences where they sort of redefined what their sense of self was. Their self was not just this bag of bones that we are, but it encompassed something larger, whether it was their relationships, their community, or nature. They felt mm-hmm. part of something larger that was going to survive, and that this, I think, is what made it easier to die. And in other cases, they had encounters with their cancer. I remember another woman who was living in deathly fear of recurrence. She'd been successfully treated for ovarian cancer. And in her trip, she went into her body and she saw this black mass
right.
under her rib cage. And she immediately recognized that it wasn't her cancer because it was in the wrong place, but it was her fear.
Mm-hmm.
And she screamed at it. She said, "Get the F out of my body." And it went away for good. She came out of the experience and in the years since has not been afraid.
What a gift.
And
what
the
a
insight.
Gift.
It's remarkable. The insight she had was, you know, I can't control my cancer. It's either going to come back or not, but I can control my fear. And the experience allowed her to do that. So they were remarkable stories, and in a way, they really inspired the book and inspired me to try the drug. It was mystifying to me the kind of spiritual transformations that people underwent, and I wanted to see firsthand what that was all about.
Talk a little bit about the role of improvisation in your work. I mean, on the one hand, as human beings, we're always improvising every day, but you've really gone out there and improvised fiercely, I have to say. So talk a little
yeah.
bit about that freedom in your work.
Well, you know, you can plan all you want and outline all you want, but when you're writing, you know, one sentence is producing the next sentence, and one paragraph is producing the next paragraph, and very often you find yourself going in directions you didn't expect to go. Sometimes they're wrong turns, and you have to kind of wheel back the clock and find that point where you went amiss, went wrong. But very often, that's exactly where you need to go. And something in the process itself, something in the nature of writing, and I think this is true for playing music and dance and many things, it has its own kind of inertia, and it becomes a way of thinking. You know, writers often say, "I don't know what I think till I write it."
Right.
But that's really true.
Mm-hmm.
I can, you know, roughly formulate ideas, but it's in that process. Even the choice of word is feeding you suggestions. Metaphors feed you suggestions, and they take you places. So it's a kind of dialogue. I teach writing, and I try to remind my students that, you know, more than half of writing is really reading.
Absolutely.
You compose a sentence. And that doesn't take that long. And then you stare at it and you read it a few times and you say, "Is this what I believe? Is it true? Is this the best way I can put it?" And then you fix it, edit, and move on. So it's a dialectic between you and the words on the page or on the screen. And I don't know where things come from, but a lot of writing, a lot of moving forward in a narrative is responding to what you've already done. It is improvisational. And I think psychedelic experience, too, is a kind of extreme version of improvisation.
Right.
You have very limited powers of direction. You can sort of steer the ship to some extent, but basically you're riding a wave. It's more like surfing. And surfing, of course, it depends entirely on improvisation.
Not that so I've true. Maybe next time.
Maybe next time. Bill Finnegan already wrote that book. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. We've been talking with Michael Pollan, who is the author of How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. You can meet him Friday, November 8th at 7:30 at Loyola University's Roussel Hall. He appears in conversation with ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin, author of Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, and Randy Fertel, author of A Taste for Chaos, The Art of Literary Improvisation. This is part of the Improv Conference. Tickets available at improvconferencenola.com. Michael, thank you so much.
No, my pleasure. It was a great pleasure to talk to you.
The first mushroom makes room for my mind to get inside the magic room of Dionysius' house. Time is over, war is over. I am safe and sound. I live and love, I drink and
here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Stephen Landry discusses and signs Beatles Day in New Orleans, Tuesday, October 22nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Sonia Purnell presents her book, A Woman of No Importance, The Untold Story of the American Spy Who Helped Win World War II. Wednesday, October 23rd at the National World War II Museum. Reception at 5, presentation at 6, book signing at 7. Stephen Weissman discusses his new book, The Chosen Wars, How Judaism Became an American Religion, with Walter Isaacson. Wednesday, October 24th at 7 at the Jewish Community Center, 5342 St. Charles Avenue. T.R. Johnson appears in conversation with Gwen Tompkins to discuss New Orleans, a literary history, Thursday, October 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Dan Raphael, Wendy Carlisle, and Jeff Weddle read from their work, Thursday, October 24th at 8 at Bar Redux, 801 Poland. Four poets, Paul Benton, Michael True, Caroline Rowe, and Jonathan Warren, perform their work Saturday, October 26th from 3:30 to 6 at Blue Cypress Books. Todd Elliott discusses and signs his novel, The Lower Line, Sunday, October 27th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, Octavia Books presents Ta-Nehisi Coates reading and discussing his first novel, Water Dancer, in conversation with novelist Jesmyn Ward, Wednesday, October 30th at 6 at Temple Sinai, 6227 St. Charles Avenue. Tickets available at Octavia Books. And get ready for the Louisiana Book Festival November 2nd at the State Capitol in Baton Rouge. This year's winner of the Louisiana Writer Award is Tulane University's Richard Campanella. Get ready for a full day of activities for both young and adult readers, and it's all free. And after that, it's time for Improv NOLA, a festival of ideas, which takes place November 3rd and picks up again November 8th through 10th. Today's guests, Jules Pfeiffer and Michael Pollan, are the headliners. Check out improvconferencenola.com for tickets and the complete schedule. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. Thank you.